Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello and welcome. I'd like to start our episode off this week with a little thought experiment. So imagine you're 15 years old. You're hanging out with your best friend on one fine spring afternoon. You decide to spend the afternoon fishing, and then you find yourself stranded in the middle of the ocean on a small boat with no way to get out. Sounds like a nightmare, right? That's my personal nightmare. But that was the reality for the two people we're going to be discussing today, Troy Driscoll and Josh Long. And I don't know, I've told a lot of these stories, and every time something like this happens to someone, it's terrible. It's always terrible, of course. I mean, anyone in a survival situation is going to have a bad time. But there's something a little extra to me about having it be a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old. That sounds like an extra layer of nightmare because you're a kid, you barely know how life works, and you're just at that age where you're like starting to be a real person. Not to offend any 15 or 17-year-old listeners, because obviously you are real people, but you know what I mean? Like, you're just starting to become like an older teenager in going into your young adult life. So there's still a lot to learn at that age, and you're still, for most people at least, for me, I was relying a lot on my parents. So to imagine being put in a really intense survival situation that most people wouldn't even survive, that just gives it an extra layer of terrifying. In some regard, being that age might give you a leg up because you're young, you're probably healthier than you would be in your older age, so that would definitely help. But to me, being a teenager and being put into a situation like this, for whatever reason in my mind, makes it worse. So our story is going to take place just off the coast of South Carolina in the spring of 2005. 17-year-old Josh Long and 15-year-old Troy Driscoll were best friends who spent a lot of time together. Josh said Troy was like a younger brother to him. Troy stayed almost the whole summer at Josh's house. The two were inseparable. One thing Troy appreciated about Josh was that once he was your friend, he was your friend until the end. He was very loyal and cared a lot about the people in his life. On Sunday, April 24th, 2005, the boys woke up with nothing to do. So Troy had the idea to take Josh's boat out on the ocean to go fishing. And as two teenage boys typically have, they had the what-could-go-wrong mentality. Even though taking the boat out on the ocean would be more difficult than, say, the bay or the river, they figured they could fight the currents and they would be fine. And on top of that, Troy's idea was to go shark fishing on the ocean. But what Troy didn't know at the time of suggesting this was that Josh's boat was just a very small rowboat. So Josh initially agreed to the idea of taking the boat out and going shark fishing, and then he led Troy to the shed where he kept his rowboat. And the first time Josh took him out there to show him the boat, Troy laughed because he was expecting a lot more from this boat. He thought it would be a bit nicer than it was. Josh basically described the boat as just a project of his. It was not the best boat, but in his words, it floats. Josh had only just finished rebuilding this boat, so it had no engine or sails, and the two of them had actually never used it before that day. But they needed something to do, and they wanted to go fishing, so the bare minimum of the boat just floating would have to do. So the boys hooked up the boat to the back of Josh's car and headed off to Sullivan's Island, which was a popular fishing spot just off the coast of South Carolina. The weather was pretty good that day, and where they would be launching their boat into the water was very calm. The boys had fished the waters around Sullivan's Island before, so they were expecting their day to go as usual. The plan was to be out on the water for only a few hours, and then head back home to get ready for school the next day, because it was a Sunday. But right before putting the boat into the water, Troy had realized that he forgot the bait in the truck, so he ran back to grab it. And while he was at the truck, he decided to leave his cell phone in the glove compartment, like Josh had done. Troy's dad was very strict about cell phones, and since his father was the one paying for the phone, Troy didn't want to potentially get it wet and break the phone, so he just left it in the car. So he tossed his cell phone in the glove box with Josh's and ran back to the boat. And once he got there, the guys were ready to launch. So they ran together on either side of the boat into the water, they hopped inside, and they started rowing. Each of them had a paddle. There was an area not too far away from the shore that had two sandbars, and they decided to head toward that area. That way they could hang out between the two of them, and they figured fish and sharks would be hanging out in that gully between the two, so it would be a pretty good place for them to spend their day. And they were having a really good time at the start. Troy really enjoyed the waves and that the boat was bouncing up and down as they went. But in their excitement to get out there fishing, the boys had made a pretty massive mistake. They hadn't checked the Coast Guard warnings. If they had, they would have seen that there was a very powerful riptide forecast for that morning right in the water that they were paddling in. So for those of you who don't know, a riptide or a rip current is a specific type of water current that can occur near beaches where the waves break. A rip is a strong, localized, and narrow current of water that moves directly away from the shore by cutting through the lines of breaking waves like a river flowing out to sea. The force of the current in a rip is strongest and fastest next to the surface of the water. Rip currents can be very hazardous to people in the water. Swimmers who are caught in a rip current and who do not understand what is happening or who may not have the necessary water skills may panic and exhaust themselves trying to swim directly against the flow of water. Because of these factors, rip currents are the leading cause of rescues by lifeguards at beaches. In the U.S., they cause an average of 71 deaths by drowning per year as of 2022. Moving at speeds of up to 8 feet per second, rip currents can move faster than an Olympic swimmer. So getting caught in a riptide or a rip current is extremely dangerous, especially if you are swimming in the water, but for Troy and Josh, it was still dangerous for them because they couldn't paddle hard enough against it to get back to the shore. Just as a general rule of thumb while I'm on the topic, if you are swimming in a rip current, you're supposed to swim parallel to the shore and swim back to land at an angle. But as we know, Josh and Troy were in a boat, which did help their situation, but they still didn't have any control. At this point, the boys were paddling to the sandbars and were still pretty unaware of the riptide. But just as they were almost to their destination, they were hit with that current. Josh noticed that they had been drifting off course, so he told Troy that they were drifting. But Troy thought that Josh was joking, so he was still just enjoying the moment. Even when he realized Josh was being serious, he still thought that this was a fun situation. He laughed about the fact that they didn't have control and they were on an adventure. But Josh, on the other hand, was not having fun. In fact, he had gotten really serious very quickly. He knew how serious the situation they were in could be, so he yelled to Troy that they needed to get out of there. They weren't that far off from land at that point, but they were completely at the mercy of the current. Josh recognized that they were caught in this current, and despite how hard they paddled, they were moving backwards and farther out in the ocean. Josh and Troy only paddled harder to try to get back to land, but the harder they paddled and the more energy they spent made no difference. They were fully caught in the riptide, and it was pulling them out to open ocean. The boys were shocked when they saw how far out they had gotten in such a short amount of time. Josh dropped the anchor into the water, hoping that it would catch on something and keep them where they were, but they just kept drifting. And what was so frustrating about this moment was they were still close enough to land that they could see people jogging on the beach, so they stopped paddling for a moment and waved and yelled at them, hoping that the people would stop and recognize that they needed help. But they were far enough out that nobody heard them. That must have been such a scary situation. You're close enough to land that you can see it and you can still see people and you try to get them to help you, but you're far enough out and you're moving fast enough that nobody can hear you and there's really nothing anyone can do at this point. I mean, if they had been spotted, then they could have called the Coast Guard and they could have been rescued really quickly, but nobody noticed because they were in their own world on the beach. It had only taken minutes for the boys to be dragged hundreds of yards out to sea. So they were in serious trouble. They knew their paddling wasn't doing anything for their situation, so they needed to come up with another plan. So Josh put the top of his wetsuit on and handed Troy his paddle and jumped into the water and started swimming. His plan was to swim to the sandbar with the anchor rope and then pull the boat to safety once he had gotten on the sandbar. But in a panic, Troy also decided to jump into the water and try to swim for the sandbar. And almost immediately, he realized the strength of the current beneath him. He had started really struggling above the water and screaming for Josh. The problem was is that Josh didn't really tell Troy his plan, he just jumped into the water. So Troy, thinking he should probably follow suit, jumped in after him. And Josh, who was not too far away from the sandbar, looked back and saw Troy was nearly drowning at this point. It was as if something was continuously pulling Troy underwater. As he fought to stay above water, he could feel the energy being sucked out of his body. So Josh swam back to Troy and grabbed him and helped him to stay above water and then back into the boat. After helping Troy into the boat, Josh could not swim to the sandbar because that would have taken far too much more energy, so he climbed in after him. And things were only getting worse by the second. It had only been 20 minutes since they first launched into the water, but they were being pulled out to open ocean at such a quick pace, and there was nothing they could do about it. And like I said earlier, they were only planning on being out there for just a few hours, so they had no water, no food, they left their cell phones in the truck, and they were completely exposed. Josh told Troy not to worry. Someone would be coming for them soon. And so while they waited for that, Josh decided he would do some fishing. That was why they were out there in the first place, so they might as well have a little fun. So Troy handed Josh his new fishing pole. But just as Josh had stood up and gotten the pole rigged up and was ready to cast it, a wave hit the side of the boat. And the wave knocked Josh over and sent his new fishing pole into the water, and it sunk pretty much immediately. The pole was gone, and Josh was understandably upset. It was his brand new pole, and he had just lost it. So in a complete frustrated rage, he started throwing some of their other things they brought. He was screaming and cussing and basically flailing around in this small boat having a temper tantrum. So after a few seconds of that, Troy yelled at Josh that he needed to calm down because this was the last thing they needed. And him losing his shit wasn't going to help them at all. And that was actually one of the worst things that could have happened at that point, because not only did Josh lose his brand new pole, which is unfortunate, but that was like their only lifeline when it came to food. They didn't bring any food, and at the very least, they could have potentially fished for food, but now they couldn't. It seemed like either Troy didn't have a pole with him, or Josh threw that when he got really frustrated. It's unclear, but after this moment, they have nothing left. They had maybe a few loose hooks and some fishing wire, but other than that, they really didn't have much else. As night fell, there was still no sign of rescue. Troy started asking Josh when someone would find them, and if they'd be floating around in the ocean until then. He was just taking stock of their situation. But Josh was basically like, "Dude, shut up, it's gonna be fine, it's only been one day." Their parents would realize they hadn't come home that night, and they would send for help. Those questions did make me laugh a little bit, because he's like, "So what are we gonna do, float around in the ocean for the next however long?" And that's just funny to me because, I mean, yeah, what the hell else are you gonna do? You're in a boat by yourself with absolutely nothing else. So looks like you're gonna be doing a lot of floating until someone finds you. But Josh was still under the impression that they would be found in the near future. He knew that his parents would notice they were gone and immediately alert someone because they knew the two had gone fishing. But Troy knew things were looking bad for them. They couldn't see land anymore, they didn't have any food or water, or their phones, so they were at the complete mercy of the ocean. But at the same time, he was trying to keep his hopes up because it had only been a few hours and he knew their parents would notice they hadn't come home. And back at home, their parents had noticed their absence. The boys hadn't been seen in over 10 hours, so Josh's dad, Eddie Long, called the Coast Guard station for help. And the first question they asked him was, where did the boys launch from? They needed to know that in order to know where to start their search. Because not only is the ocean a big place, but they weren't even sure that the boys were in the ocean. there were other bodies of water around where they could have been fishing, like rivers and lakes and, you know, whatever else is in that area. It wasn't just the ocean. But unfortunately, Eddie had no idea where his son had gone. And that was a problem because the Coast Guard couldn't launch a search until they knew exactly where the boys had entered the water. So that started Eddie's own personal search to try to find his son's car. The first place he checked was the river, where he believed the boys may have gone fishing. But he soon found that there was absolutely no sign of them there, so that led him to checking the shoreline of the ocean. He went out on the beach close to Sullivan's Island and started walking with a flashlight. He said he stopped walking probably about 100 yards from where his son's trailer was, but the truck was black, and also it had begun storming, so he didn't see the car. And even when he drove by his son's truck, he missed it. So with no sign of where the boys had launched from, and the storm making it impossible to see anything, he realized there would be no search that night. Meanwhile, out in the ocean, Josh and Troy were having a terrible time. Like I said, a storm had begun, and they were really battling the waves and the rain in their tiny rowboat. They constantly had to try and get water out of the boat, that way it would stay afloat, and in the process of doing that, they were soaked and freezing. The waves had been battering this boat, and the temperature had dropped to below freezing. With every wave that hit them, it felt like they were in an ice bath. The two of them tried to lay down in the boat to get out of the wind as much as possible to keep warm, but it wasn't working. They decided they needed to cuddle together for body heat. That night really put into perspective how much trouble they were in out there. They started their evening believing that they would be rescued, to now understanding that their lives were in real danger. This situation was just terrifying because, for me personally, thinking about being in the ocean at night in a storm, in any boat, like even a cruise ship, is a no-no for me. But thinking about being in a tiny rowboat with only two paddles and facing a storm sounds like an actual nightmare that I have had. Like one wave that's just a little too big and your boat is toast, and then you're in the water. Even if they were just out there at night in the ocean in their little rowboat and battling hypothermia, which is enough in my opinion, now they also had to deal with a storm. Things just keep getting worse for these two, and they are really understanding the situation they're in at this point. That initial panic they had turned to true terror as they shivered and battled this storm. They couldn't understand why they were still out there. Why hadn't they been found? Their belief that they would be rescued had slowly started to dwindle as the hours passed. By the next morning, both of the boys were exhausted. Neither of them slept much at all. But as the sun came up, their situation, unfortunately, only got worse. Following the storm, as they looked 360 degrees around the boat, they realized they were completely surrounded by water. There was no sign of land or life anywhere. They had nowhere to go and nothing to do. And now, as the day passed, they had to endure the heat and constant exposure to the sun. So they were burning, and they had no shade. Their clothes that had been soaked from the waves had begun to dry, which theoretically was good, but was extremely uncomfortable because the salt water made their clothes crusty and rough on their skin. That's something you never think about. Being soaked with ocean water and then staying in the same clothes, having them air dry, and then having salt particles all over your body. Terrible. So every so often, Josh and Troy would jump into the water to cool themselves off and to get their minds off of things. Swimming a little made both of them feel just a little bit better. But what they didn't know was the water they were swimming in was notorious for sharks. And you might be thinking, well, yeah, of course there were sharks. They were in the ocean. But they probably wouldn't actually encounter one. If you were thinking that, you would be wrong. Because not long after the two of them had jumped into the water, they looked beneath them to the deep below and saw a shark dart up toward them and bump their boat. Seeing that, they both scrambled to the boat and climbed inside. The water was so clear, they could see the shark swimming around beneath them, and it was a good size. It was a good 7 or 8 feet long shark. And there were a few of them circling underneath the boat. So it's safe to say that ended their swim time. Back on shore, Josh's father received some news from the Coast Guard. The call came in around 10:30 a.m. They told him that they had located Josh's car, and when Eddie found out that it had been on Sullivan's Island, his heart dropped because he knew that he had missed it, and if he had seen it, the search for his son would have started like 12 hours ago. It also confirmed his worst fear that his son and Troy were in fact in the ocean. Once Eddie got to Josh's truck, they opened up his car and found both of the boys' cell phones and wallets in the glove box. At least at this point, they knew where the boys had launched from and could start a full-scale search, but the boys had drifted so far that any kind of search would not be an easy task. A church down the street opened up to the search and allowed them to set up shop in their recreation center. The press started to show up, friends, family, community members, hundreds of people showed up to this search. They had people on land, in the water, even in the air searching for these boys. The Coast Guard had shown Eddie a map of the area that they would be searching in. They told him based off of their calculations, they couldn't have gone farther than a certain point, which gave Eddie confidence. He felt like they would surely find the boys that day. With all that effort, they had to find them. But by that time, the boys had already drifted 90 miles north of the search area. Out at sea, Troy and Josh were battling the sun and the fact that they hadn't drank any water in the past 24 hours. Both of them were battling extreme dehydration. Their bodies had lost over 3 pints of fluid, causing headaches, muscle cramps, and extreme disorientation. They were desperate for a drink. There were no clouds in the sky, and as the day went on, it only got hotter. Their mouths got drier and drier, and with each hour that passed, it became more tempting to drink the seawater. Obviously, that wasn't a good idea, but the boys decided they wouldn't drink the seawater, but they would gargle it and spit it back out. That way they had something wet in their mouths, and it was cold, so it would help them just a little bit. It tasted terrible, but at least it was cold. And as time passed, they didn't care so much if they swallowed a little bit. They knew it was terrible for them and would kill them quicker, but at that point, they really didn't care. And I know that drinking seawater is really terrible and leads to dehydration faster, but I didn't realize that the human kidneys can only make urine that is less salty than salt water. Therefore, to get rid of all of the excess salt taken in by drinking seawater, you have to urinate more water than you drink. So even though you are technically taking in some kind of water, you would only become thirstier and thirstier and eventually die of dehydration. I knew it was because of the salt in the water, but I didn't realize that it would make you pee more. That does make sense, though, but it is really scary. They were already extremely weak, but as night fell, the boys had to battle another storm and severe drop in temperature. The only thing to do was huddle together to keep each other warm. They decided they would both stay awake and talk to each other and make sure they were okay. Meanwhile, Eddie was still in the church holding an all-night vigil for the boys. He still hadn't gotten any news and the Coast Guard weren't searching through the storm, so he would have to wait until morning once again. This is a terrible and frightening and dire situation for the boys, of course, but imagining Eddie sitting in the church all night long, as a storm is going, knowing that nobody is searching for his son, and wondering what they were going through out there, also sounds like some kind of torture. Like, that is terrible. That must be such a helpless feeling, knowing that your son and his friend are out there somewhere, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. On the morning of day 3, the boys woke up full of despair. But off in the distance, Troy spotted a small boat. Immediately, he started screaming and waving, and Josh soon followed suit. The fishing boat was only about 100 yards away, so both of them believed their luck was finally turning around. But the boys soon realized that the boat had just kept on moving. They hadn't spotted them. Their boat was so small out there, it was like a needle in a haystack. It was nice to see some kind of life out there, but at the same time, they lost a bit of hope. They had begun to realize how unlikely it was that they would be spotted out there. They really started getting pessimistic. They felt like the ocean was so big, and if they hadn't been found already, there was no way anyone was going to find them out there. Which brings us to day 4. Eddie began another day's search, determined to stay optimistic. He gave a pep talk to the search team, and every day he got up, he would feel like today was the day they were going to find them. He didn't let that pessimism creep into his mind. He had to stay positive for his son. On top of the Coast Guard search, Eddie was also going out on the water and searching the ocean himself. But it was tough because their search area only got bigger every day. The more time that passed, the further out their boat could go and was going. So they had a really huge area to cover at that point. Despite the massive Coast Guard and community effort, there was still no sign of them. Out on the water, Troy said every day was like Groundhog's Day. It was all the same. They would wake up and they were still surrounded by water, still with no food, no water, and nothing to do. Their dehydration had gotten exponentially worse. But like I said in the beginning, the fact that they were young and in good shape did help them a lot. Even still, Josh said he hadn't truly understood the meaning of starving or being parched until that moment. Both of them were extremely weak, a kind of weakness neither of them had ever experienced before. And their dehydration had become life-threatening. But despite their desperate need for water, all Troy could think about was food. His hands had begun peeling really badly because of how dry and cracked they had become, so he took pieces of his dry, cracked skin, balled it up, and put it on a hook they had left over in the boat to try to fish with it. Which honestly is kind of a smart idea. But every time he'd put this hook with a small piece of his skin in the water, the tiny fish would quickly eat the skin and then get away. It wasn't working as he had hoped, and they didn't end up catching any fish. But Troy had become so desperate he was prepared to eat pretty much anything. He said he had to have something in his mouth that had some kind of texture, and that's when he picked up the knife. Not to kill Josh, don't worry, but he did start picking away at his fingers more, and when Josh noticed what he was doing, he got really concerned, and rightfully so, because Troy was damn near about to cut his entire finger off and eat it. Troy had been basically just touching the blade to his skin, and he hadn't cut it yet, but it was clear that he was really considering it. So Josh snatched the knife from him, and when he did, Troy sincerely asked Josh if he would cut his finger off for him. He couldn't cut his own finger off, but Josh could do it. And Josh was not having any of that. There was no world in which he was going to cut his friend's finger off, so he told him that he was crazy, and there was no way that was happening. I can't really imagine getting to the point of being so hungry that you want to cut your own finger off. I have been very lucky to never experience that type of hunger. But also I have to think about the fact that he was a 15-year-old boy. And 15-year-old boys eat like that's their job. They are growing, after all. I mean, one of my cousins growing up used to eat like 4 cartons of eggs a week or something crazy like that. Like, he was just inhaling food. So I can only imagine that a growing 15-year-old boy could potentially get to the point where he's considering cutting off his own finger. But Josh was not having that. He's like, listen, dude, I'm not cutting off your finger. And also, you're stupid for thinking that. And, you know, he was. But he was a 15-year-old boy, so we'll give him a little bit of leeway. Back on the shore, after 3 days of searching, the Coast Guard gave Eddie some terrible news. They told him they had been searching for 3 days, and it had been the most extensive search in North Carolina's history, and they still hadn't found anything. They were telling him that they had to call off the search. They weren't completely finished, but they were shifting their search to a body recovery mission. Starting first thing in the morning, they would begin combing the beaches for bodies. So they were done going onto the water and actually searching for a boat. They would just be searching for bodies that had washed up on the beach. Eddie couldn't believe what he was hearing. His heart was broken to think about his son possibly being gone forever. Throughout the whole thing, Eddie prayed. He felt completely helpless at that point. Meanwhile, out at sea, the boys were facing another night, and they both couldn't shake the thought that they might never be found. Troy was thinking that all he would ever get were those 15 years he had already lived. Anytime they would think about their families, they would get really emotional, and of course they did. They were terrified, and they were facing their mortality. At some point, both of them drifted off to sleep, because thankfully it wasn't storming that night. But the next thing Josh knew, he was being woken up to the sound of an engine. When he opened his eyes, he saw that there was a massive cargo ship headed directly toward them. Josh immediately woke Troy up, and he was shocked to see how big this cargo ship was. He had never been anywhere near something that big. It was multiple stories high. At first, they thought, okay, let's wave, because there have to be people on that ship. But as they stood there waving and shouting, the ship only got closer and closer until it was clear that if they didn't move out of the way, they would just be crushed by this cargo ship. Clearly, they had not been seen, and now they were about to be killed. I mean, this ship was massive, and it was nighttime, and they were in a tiny little rowboat. So, frantically, the two of them began rowing as hard as they possibly could to get out of the way. And thankfully, that, coupled with the swell created by the ship cutting through the water, pushed them out of the way just in time. Once they were out of the way and the ship continued to go right past them, they continued screaming and waving, but it was nighttime and nobody was out on the deck of the ship. Also, compared to that thing, they were a speck in the ocean. After a minute, they just stood there and watched it pass. It was so close they could almost touch it. The boys felt like this was their last hope of being saved, because if this cargo ship that was only a few feet from them couldn't see them and save them, they had no chance of another ship hundreds or even thousands of feet away seeing them. They were completely defeated. And that brings us to the morning of day 5. They were in the most extreme stage of dehydration. Over 20% of their body fluids were gone. Their vital organs were shutting down, and they had begun drifting in and out of consciousness. Very few people ever survive this level of dehydration, and it is physically painful. They were also losing it. Troy felt like he was just dying a slow and painful death, and he didn't want to do it anymore. Josh tried to comfort his best friend, but it had all become too much. He was trying so hard to stay strong for Troy because he looked at himself as an older brother figure. But he was only 17 and was battling demons of his own. He had managed to calm Troy down, but Josh couldn't handle it either. Which was when he dove into the water and swam down as deep as he could. He said they didn't believe in suicide, but at that point he felt like if a shark came up and ate him, he wouldn't care. Also, the fact that he swam that deep, in that state of exhaustion, he knew he may not be able to swim back up. It was a deliberate decision on his part. He said he swam somewhere around 30 to 40 feet deep or something like that. Like, it was really deep. Meanwhile, Troy was on the surface losing his mind. He was just screaming for Josh. He sat there looking at the surface of the water and not seeing his friend come up. Under the water, Josh began thinking about what he was doing and what that really meant. He thought about all the people he would lose, all the life he wouldn't get to live. His family would lose him, which would devastate them. Thinking about all of that, Josh swam up and finally resurfaced and gasped for air. Troy was extremely relieved. Josh felt like he couldn't do it. In his words, if God took him, then so be it, but it wasn't going to be his doing. Once back in the boat, the two went back to doing what they had been doing, a whole lot of nothing. By that night, Josh could tell that Troy had become really, really weak. He didn't want to move, he was barely speaking, and it wasn't looking good for him. So Josh talked to him all night because he didn't want Troy to die, so he was just trying to keep him awake and make sure that he didn't die. But Troy wanted to be dead at that point. And that night, he asked Josh to kill him. He asked Josh if he would just stab him. Josh told him there was no way he would do that. First of all, Troy was his best friend. But also, if Troy died, then Josh wouldn't have been able to come home and tell his parents that he let their baby boy die. Morale was very low. Every night that it wasn't storming, the boys would see glowing jellyfish all around their boat. They called them jelly balls. And at that point, Troy was starting to look at these jelly balls differently. Not only were they something he could eat, but he thought to himself, if this thing is poisonous and it killed him, he would be happy with that outcome. It was potentially a way out of the situation. He hoped that it would just be quicker than the rate that they were dying now. So he picked one up and looked at it for a moment before he took a big bite. He wasn't going to just take one bite and potentially get really sick. He wanted to eat a lot, so it took him out on the first go. But they had no effect. Back on land, Eddie was losing hope. He was having a really hard time thinking about what his son and Troy must be going through. It was terrible to think that they might already be dead, but if they were still out there on the water, it was even worse to think about what state they might be in and what they were going through. Every night when he would come home, he would drive down the street and see that someone in his neighborhood had lined his street with bags with candles in them, and they were out every night and they led right up to his house. The community was extremely supportive of the search, and then of Eddie and the boys' families. But it was starting to look like they would need to prepare for a memorial service. And that brings us to day 6. Josh knew that they were basically just waiting to die at that point. They both had a moment where they cried because they didn't actually want to die. They knew they were too young to die. They just wanted their suffering to end. It was an extremely painful, agonizing death, and Troy knew they didn't have much longer. Their dehydration was so advanced, they were at the point where they only had a few more hours to live. Josh told Troy they should write something down. They scratched out their final goodbyes to their families on the boat. They said they were sorry, they loved them, Josh thanked them for their support, and goodbye. Troy wrote to his mom and dad and thanked them for everything they had done for him, and thanks for everything they taught him. They were at the end of their rope. They could only wait for death at that point. But as they lay there, Troy heard the rumble of an engine, and it was getting louder. When he turned around, he saw this large fishing boat that was still far away, but it was headed straight for them. So he and Josh used what little energy they had to stand up one last time. They were screaming and waving and crying, although at this point they had no more fluid in them left to produce tears. As they waved and waved, the boat got closer, and finally, they could tell that they had been spotted by the people on board. The fishing boat pulled up alongside their tiny rowboat, and the men pulled them inside. Troy had so little energy left, he couldn't even stand to get into the boat. They had to physically lift him in. The two of them flopped on the deck and immediately were given water. Captain Rick Smith said the boys were so full of emotion, they went through every single one in the book. But the boys were given water and hugs, and they knew they were going to be okay. And that's when Captain Rick called the Coast Guard. And when Eddie got that call, the Coast Guard told him, "We have your son. Do you want to speak with him?" And when he first heard Josh's voice, Eddie said he didn't even sound like himself. He was so incredibly weak, he sounded like an entirely different person. It was devastating to hear, but at the same time, it was the most relieved he could have possibly been. Everyone involved felt like this was a miracle. Doctors said the boys were within hours of death when they were finally rescued. And at the hospital, the families were finally reunited, and the boys made full recoveries. They couldn't believe they got a second chance at life. Both Troy and Josh say that living through that experience has given them a new perspective on life. They feel like they can face anything now. They will never give up because they have been to the edge and lived. Captain Rick formed a bond with Troy and Josh and said that the ordeal changed his whole life as well. The guys were interviewed 10 years after everything, so in 2015, and Josh said, "I think about it quite often. I still have the boat. Every time I see the boat, I'm like, oh my goodness, how did I live on that?" Troy said, "It hits home every once in a while. A lot of times I think, why did I make it? And why was it me? At the same time, it was a blessing because it really helped me out in life, because now it shows how important life is and how short it is. At the same time, I'm really thankful for a lot of things in life now." At the time of that interview, Troy was 25, and at this point, he's now almost 35. He's a firefighter with the Old Fort Fire Department, and he said he's been a fireman since he was 18 years old. His dad was one for 25 years, and he followed in his footsteps. And he said it's the best thing he's done in his life. "I help people out. It's a good brotherhood to help someone out. I've actually done some boat rescues, and to be a part of that, it brings back memories. And if I can help somebody out like people help search for me, it makes me feel really good." Around the time of the interview, Troy also had a daughter. Her name is Mackenzie, and he said, "She's my heart, and I live for her every day." Josh is now somewhere in his late 30s. At the time of the interview in 2015, he was 27 and was in the National Guard and in the process of starting his own construction company. He has 4 children, Ethan, Joshua, Jacob, and Jasmine, and he said, "I have a wonderful family and beautiful kids, and I know that's what I'm here for." As for their adventure at sea, they both said it was all for a purpose. Troy says, a lot of people came together to help me and Josh out. It was a life-saving event that not only changed our lives, it helped a lot of people in Charleston realize it's a good community that we live in. I'm very thankful. And that is the story of Troy Driscoll and Josh Long and their harrowing experience on a tiny rowboat in the middle of the ocean. I mean, what a story. They were incredibly lucky to be saved when they were. It feels like whenever we have a story like this, it always happens where the people are saved just in the nick of time. I mean, they were saved hours from death, truly hours. It's honestly impressive that they lasted as long as they did because they had no water for 6 days. The food they could, you know, technically live without for a longer period of time, but dehydration is no joke. And the fact that they lasted that long is honestly shocking. So they truly were almost out of time when they were saved, and thankfully they were saved. They were also incredibly lucky to have each other in that situation because although they were both going through the most difficult period of their lives, they at least had the other to help them through. When Troy was spiraling about wanting to end his life, Josh calmed him down. When Josh jumped into the water and resurfaced, Troy pulled him back into the boat. When Troy wanted Josh to stab him, Josh told him, absolutely no way that's happening. So they really needed each other in that moment, and it doesn't make the situation less terrible and painful, but at least they were with their best friend. You know, if you have to be in a survival situation, you'd probably want it to be with someone you love a lot. And I wasn't going to make this comment while I was telling the story because it just wasn't the time for it, but imagine biting into a jellyfish. I think I would hate every second of that. And I know he wasn't doing it because he's like, I just am curious about how jellyfish tastes. Like, he was obviously in a really dark place. He was hoping it would end his life, so that's horrible. But the texture, ooh, that couldn't have been good. That couldn't have been good. I'm not really someone who has a texture issue when it comes to food, but I draw the line at jellyfish. I guess jellyfish is better than him cutting off his own finger to eat that, but not much better. Also, that whole finger scenario would have been really bad. If Josh wasn't there to tell Troy to not cut off his finger and, like, physically take the knife away, who knows what would have happened. If Troy actually cut his finger off, that would have introduced a whole slew of other problems because, I mean, logically speaking, a finger is not very big. You can only eat so much of it. I mean, that's nasty, of course. You'd probably get sick from literally consuming your own flesh uncooked, but that's a crazy thought. But also, he then would have like a terrible open wound. He'd be bleeding. It would probably get infected and he probably would have died. I mean, that alone probably would have killed him. So, and that was on day what? 2? 3? I don't even know. I mean, early on. It was too early on to cut off your finger. Although I try not to judge because I was obviously not in that situation and I hope to never be in that situation and know what that feeling was like. So, you know, just we're having a conversation. We're spitballing here. But yeah, obviously we wish Josh and Troy nothing but the best. I think they have endured enough badness for one lifetime. And, you know, it's lovely that they now have kids and families and they're living their lives and seem to be doing what they love. So that's really amazing. And the fact that it gave them a real appreciation and perspective on their life is really beautiful. And it really affected Captain Rick in a certain way. He was like, hey, this changed my life as well. Obviously, he didn't live through the 6 days on the boat with them. But the fact that he found them in the middle of the ocean and pulled them out of that situation, he's like, yeah, that's pretty incredible, and I'm going to appreciate life more as well, which I think is a positive. So anyway, that's really all I have to say about that. Why don't we have a bit of a palate cleanser, and I will tell you something good. My good thing is that Alex's birthday is tomorrow. He wished he could be here on this episode. We had another episode planned, but something came up at work and he was unable to be here. So hopefully he'll be on next week's. But yeah, tomorrow's his birthday and we're going to get together with a couple friends and we're going to go eat some food and get a little silly and probably sing some karaoke, which is, you know, just our favorite things to do. So perfect for a birthday situation. And yeah, if you want to show Alex some birthday love, head over to notsodaypodcast.myshopify.com and peruse around. Maybe get a sweatshirt. I don't know. But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to vote on stories you want to hear and hear a bunch of bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you would like to see pictures we post of all the stories we talk about, check us out on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T on the end of podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.